Gaza. So much so that mainstream media ran stories claiming that Biden is now considering conditioning military aid to Zionist Israel if they invade Rafah. With us is our digital mainstream media expert, Ms. Julia Qasem, to tell us how much of this is actually true.
Thanks, Marwa. So, well, let us begin by saying that none of that is true. Mm-hmm. So you see, the Biden administration is preparing to send more bombs and other weapons to Zionist Israel that would add to its military arsenal, even as Biden keeps publicly pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza. So this, Marwa, is according to the Wall Street Journal, which reported last week citing current and former U.S. officials. So the proposed arms delivery includes MK-82 bombs and KMU-572 joint direct action munitions that add precision guidance to bombs and FMU-139 bomb fuses at a value estimated to be in the tens of millions of dollars.
Oh, tens of millions of dollars, and still no condition on that.
No condition, no strings. So it's true that the congressional committee leaders would have to approve this transfer first. But, you know, as we remember in December 2023, the Biden administration skipped congressional review of Israeli weapons sales to Israel, not once, but twice.
Wow.
So what's going to stop them from doing it a third time?
Absolutely
so
nothing.
Not Congress, essentially. It's enough that the Biden administration continues to unconditionally supply arms to Israel, as evidence piles up that the U.S.-made weapons have been used in strikes that have killed or injured Palestinian civilians. But now the Biden administration has the audacity to lie in the face of American taxpayers, who are fully bearing the consequences and the financial burden of these free transfers to Israel, by claiming that they will condition military aid going to Israel. So where do they think these weapons will end up? In a weapons depot somewhere underground? No. I mean, obviously they'll be used to expand the scope of the ongoing genocide in Gaza and Rafah. I mean, where else?
They will end up on the heads of innocent civilians, kids, women, elderly, just like they have been so for the past 6 months.
Right. And at the initial start, when the Zionist entity was declaring that they would invade Rafah, the Biden administration had its empty words, but they immediately approved like arms transfers. And mind you, Marwa, the whole rhetoric is false, because even back in November, Biden then said that conditioned aid to Israel was a worthy thought, as per this report by Politico, but he never actually followed up on it, of course. So in an article entitled "No Conditions on Future Israel Aid, Despite Biden's Worthwhile Thought Quip," written by Alexander Ward and Jonathan Lemire, who said that days later after Biden's statement, senior U.S. officials hit the Sunday shows to rule out the proposal, hinting but not outright saying that there wouldn't be a shift in the administration's Israel policy. So Politico reported that one of Biden administration official suggested that Biden's aside, made in response to a reporter's question, was less about siding with progressive sentiment and more of a window into his private frustrations with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So this reflects, of course, the U.S. administration's frustrations after 5 months of Israeli-U.S.-backed genocide and having nothing to show for it militarily. But at the same time, it's practically the same old script that Biden recycles every 2 months to, quote-unquote, pressure Netanyahu into a ceasefire. But it would just be easier at the time for them to just hold off on their consistent vetoes at the UN Security Council votes. And even yesterday, you know,
when they did hold off on their vote,
nothing really changed on the situation on the ground.
Yeah.
The international body was not able to, you know, stop this genocide, as we could see from the scenes.
Zionists are not ready to comply. That's it.
Of course. So to add insult to that injury, Marwa, Netanyahu not only openly defied Biden's demand to stop the planned invasion of Rafah, because the U.S. knows that they're going to lose, he also lashed out at Senator Chuck Schumer, Democratic Zionist Senate Majority Lead, calling Schumer's recent criticism of Netanyahu and call for early elections there totally inappropriate. So according to the New York Times, Netanyahu said in an interview with CNN that trying to replace the government of a sister democracy was not appropriate. "That's something that Israel, the Israeli public, does on its own," he said. "We're not a banana republic."
I find that hard to believe. Anyways, yes.
Yeah, so Netanyahu knows that he just takes tens of millions of dollars worth of U.S. taxpayer dollars for weapons, all for free from the U.S. With his other hand, he flips the bird with any American party, including the Biden administration officials, who criticize his basically failures in Gaza.
Yeah, I completely understand where that's going. And I completely am very interested and invested in how things will work out, given now that Netanyahu is now defying UNSC, the U.S. and every ally that ever stood beside him by not complying to that latest UN resolution for a temporary ceasefire. But anyways, thank you very much, Julia, for your contribution to this segment. Now, ladies and gents, we'll move on to social media expose. Comments made by former U.S. President Donald Trump during a rally in Dayton, Ohio, warning that there'd be a bloodbath for the country if he lost the upcoming elections, has taken the U.S. and social media, for that matter, by a storm. Let us remember what he said before we hear all about the hysteria from those words that were festered on social media by our social media expert, Sima Itayim. Let's hear what he said.
If I get elected... Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath.
Sima, he said it's going to be a bloodbath, and those words sparked widespread condemnation, given that recently, when he lost the elections, there was violence that ensued in the streets of the U.S. So how did social media react to this?
Hi, Marwa. Thanks for having me. So if we know Trump well, which we do, we already know that he cried fake news after the widespread condemnation he received as backlash to these comments. And he claimed it was taken out of context.
Yeah.
So in a tweet on Truth Social, since Trump's not on Twitter again yet, he wrote, "The fake news media and their Democrat partners in the destruction of our nation pretended to be shocked at my use of the word bloodbath, even though they fully understood that I was simply referring to imports allowed by crooked Joe Biden," which are crooked, capital C, which are killing the automobile industry. "The United Auto Workers, but not their leadership, fully understand what I mean. With the electric car mandate being pushed by Biden, there soon won't be any cars made in the USA, unless I'm elected president, in which case auto manufacturing will thrive like never before. MAGA 2024.
All caps lock. All uppercase.
Hysterical. So if you zoom out and you listen to the clip, you see that he really was talking about the automobile industry.
Yeah.
It was a broader discussion within that context, but it's not as cut and dry as he wants us to believe. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what he was trying to say. But it didn't go down well at all with the Democrats and the liberals.
I can see that.
For instance, Robert Reich Berkley, professor and former U.S. Secretary of Labor, went as far as calling Trump fascist.
Oh, my God.
We've heard that many times before. Yeah. He tweeted the following. "This week, Trump has warned of a bloodbath if he's not elected, promised again to release violent Jan 6 criminals, claimed immigrants aren't people, and called for the prosecution of Liz Cheney. These are warning signs of fascism. If we ignore them, here's what happens next."
What happens next?
Reich posted a 5-minute video explaining his views about this specific incident.
"I want to talk to you about the F word. No, no, not that F word. I'm talking about fascism. Is Donald Trump really a fascist, as some would say? Or is the word authoritarian sufficient? The term fascism is often used loosely, but you can generally identify fascists by their hate of the other, vengeful nationalism, and repression of dissent."
So he proceeds to list 5 steps in which Trump can turn America into a fascist state.
Ooh.
And this shows the alarming level of fracture amongst U.S. politicians when it comes to the upcoming presidential elections. Because, it's never really based in anything grounded. Like, he cited the Jan 6 Capitol Hill storming. Like, that was...
It's a circus. Oh, my God,
we know it was staged. There was footage of them letting them in. Yeah. And that's still, like, his main thing, you know? Like, that's... Anyway. So, moving on to Occupy Democrats, who sounded the alarm after both Trump's bloodbath comment and the promotional video he published right after.
Mm-hmm.
They tweeted a screenshot from the video with an extreme close-up of Trump's eyes in black and white. Not a pretty sight, I know, but let's see what they tweeted. "Breaking. Fascism experts sound the alarm after Donald Trump releases a jaw-dropping video in which he ominously threatens Democrats directly and promises to do horrible things to us.
Ooh.
With his criminal problems mounting, Trump is ripping a vile new approach straight from the fascist playbook. The indicted ex-president released a disturbing video of an extreme close-up of his eyes in black and white that visually evokes 1984 and other dystopian works of fiction."
God, Sima, that's so American.
What he said was even worse. "If you around with us, if you do something bad to us, we're going to do things to you that that have never been done before," Trump says in the video. The video doesn't expand on exactly what the things are that Trump and MAGA want to do to us, but given the long and violent history of fascism, one can imagine just how horrible they might be. Trump has already incited one violent insurrection.
Oh my God.
If he wins the White House again, he will seek retribution against all who opposed his previous coup attempt. This man belongs in prison. Lives are at stake.
Oh,
you
my
see,
God.
Marwa,
oh, my
the God. Democrats are using this as leverage against Trump. Just, grasping at straws, whatever
it's
they can.
It's overdramatic, though.
Yeah, for the upcoming elections. But we have to acknowledge that, what Trump really meant was, if I don't win this election, it won't just be a bloodbath for the auto industry, but it'll be a bloodbath for the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. People must maybe took it a bit out of. But either way, I mean, it seems the U.S. is, headed for, some interesting times, to say the least.
We're watching. We have the popcorn ready, and we're seeing how this will unfold,
yes,
especially in the upcoming few months. Thank you very much, Seema.
Thank you. I really
enjoyed this segment with you, because America and its social media is just on another planet, especially when it has to do with Trump. So thank you for showing us This was amazing, ladies and gents, but we have more for you on Figures Exposé. In the aftermath of the Trump bloodbath comment, a political magazine Ipsos poll found that most Americans think Trump should go to trial before the 2024 presidential election. 3 in 5 Americans say they think the federal trial on Donald Trump's 2020 election subversion case should take place before the presidential election in November, levels that held steady since August 2023. Now, the poll also finds that a plurality of Americans believes that Trump, if convicted, should face imprisonment over just probation, a financial penalty, or no penalty whatsoever. When asked if they believe Trump is guilty of the alleged crimes, Americans were split by partisanship. Roughly half of the respondents believe Trump is guilty of the alleged crimes in the sensitive documents case with 52%, falsifying business records case with 50%, federal 2020 election subversion case with 49%, and Georgia election subversion case with 49%. Now, believe that Trump is guilty is split by party. While a majority of Democrats say they believe Trump is guilty in all 4 cases with 86%, 86%, 87%, and 86% respectively. Now, fewer Republicans think the same with 16%, 14%, 12%, and 12% respectively. And a majority of independents believe Trump is guilty in the 4 cases with 58%, 54%, 54%, and 53%. Now, let us move on to the most notable exposé voices for this week. So we heard during our episode today voices outraged at Trump's bloodbath comment condemning the presidential candidate as a fascist and a future dictator if elected. But to be fair, there were also a lot of voices who found that this is just the way Donald Trump speaks and that he genuinely meant no harm in the context he was using the term. For one, look what Carl Emmerich had to say about this on TikTok.
Did Donald Trump just threaten violence if he loses in November at a recent rally? Well, let's play the tape in question.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole... That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
Now, I find it really funny that a lot of Republicans are saying you need to look at the full context of this clip to see he's talking about the auto industry. And the reason I find that funny is immediately before the bloodbath remarks, Trump calls for a 100% tariff on cars imported from Mexico, which is a horrible policy. Putting that aside, even without the additional context, Trump is obviously not calling for violence in that clip. Anyone that is using even a sliver of good faith interpretation can see he's clearly using figurative language. The reason I find this frustrating is Donald Trump says wild stuff all the time. For example, he recently called the January 6th prisoners hostages that he would very, very seriously consider pardoning. Talk about that, or the hundreds of other crazy things he says. There is no reason to hone in on nothing burgers like these bloodbath statements.
And we end off with Jim Walsh on TikTok, who said it really doesn't matter if Trump was literal or rhetorical in his threats. What scares Jim, apparently, is something else completely. Let us find out what it is.
So our friend Donald, the Mango Mussolini, has promised, quote, a bloodbath, unquote, if he doesn't get back in this November. And of course, the question is, does he mean literally? Is he inciting violence? Or is he just pandering to the brain-dead faithful? To me, the answer is, it doesn't matter. We just don't want this guy back in office. We got to do what we got to do to make sure he doesn't get back in. That's the worst possible scenario. He said something, though, in the speech that concerned me a lot more. When he said that he was going to go crazy with the tariffs on foreign cars. Tariffs suck. They serve a very limited special interest, but they're awful. They set the stage for depressions and wars, and have many times in our history. That's what scares me.
And with this frenzy, ladies and gents, we end off our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime military has withdrawn from the Gaza Strip's largest hospital after a two-week raid, leaving behind scenes of devastation. Hundreds of people returned to Ashifa Hospital and the surrounding area after the withdrawal recently. They reported finding bodies strewn inside and outside the facility. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with three eyewitnesses, including two journalists, who were met with scenes of absolute devastation when they reached the vicinity of the Ashifa Hospital. At dawn, April 1st, Israeli occupation forces suddenly withdrew from the Ashifa medical complex following a two-week siege and constant attacks. When they learned about the withdrawal, Gaza City residents converged on the area west of Gaza City to survey the damage caused by the Zionist regime incursion and to assess the conditions of their homes, which they were forced to evacuate. What they encountered was shocking. Palestinian journalist Badr Abdul Allah told the Palestine Chronicle, "Everything in the complex is destroyed. All the buildings of the hospital were bombed and are no longer usable." He noted, "The Ashifa Medical Complex is the largest hospital in the Gaza Strip, and it is the lifeline of the health sector in Gaza." Adel Al told Palestine Chronicle, "But now it is destroyed, and the occupation has completely taken it out of service. Israel must be held accountable for the crimes it committed in Ashifa." He continued, "All media outlets documented the crimes throughout these months, and they are still there. This crime, however, cannot pass without accountability. The occupation has violated everything in the Gaza Strip, and nobody in the world seems to be determined to stop them. Rather, major global powers are complicit and partners in massacring our Palestinian people. Ayman Hatou is another journalist who witnessed the degree of devastation left behind by the Israeli regime army. He compared the obliteration to what he saw last November when Israeli regime forces stormed the complex for the first time. Hatou told the Palestine Chronicle, "In November, the destruction was confined to the external areas and only part of..."
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, we are interrupting our normal coverage to bring you live coverage of International Quds Day rallies and marches. The last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan has been designated as International Quds Day by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. Last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan is an opportunity for freedom-seeking peoples of the world to show their support for the oppressed Palestinians and their cause. International Quds Day doesn't just belong to Palestine, it belongs to the entire Islamic Ummah. We're now going over to Press TV headquarters for this live rolling coverage of International Quds Day rallies and marches.
Of Western hegemonic interests. I mean, essentially, they're put in there by force. We can see in the countries bordering occupied Palestine that do not have normalization against Israel, but also are actively hostile to the Zionist entity and have anti-normalization laws in place, like Lebanon and Syria. The West has time and time again tried to change, influence, and enforce conditions that would allow for the war normalization to take place, such as the 13-long war in Syria financed by the West to change the government, essentially. Now, as for the people of these nations, which are obviously, you can see for the last 2 weeks, they have come out in protest against the government stance of normalization, against how their governments are aiding and abetting the West and Israel. Obviously there is a harsh repression in place in countries that are representing only Western imperialist interests in the region and not their people. But at the same time, the example of the nation that has gave us the Quds Day, Iran, also the repressive Comprador government, which was overthrown by consistent organized struggle by its people and the leadership of Imam Khomeini. So with the right combination of leadership and unified, consistent struggle, if it has shown that it's possible for any nation, any peoples that are willing to achieve sovereignty and to implement justice, for their people and for their nation. We could see basically, hopefully, the fruits of that just beginning to blossom with the awakened anger and the awakened open consciousness and open mobilization that we see in Jordan and Egypt in these recent protests.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, why do you think it has taken so long in these Arab countries to get to this point that Julie is talking about, this open consciousness or anger? Because, of course, the Palestinian situation, it's part of their own situation. And also, dealing with their own oppression inside of their countries, what has happened in your perspective that we are seeing a delayed type of reaction from these Arab countries?
Well, I think Julia is spot on that these are comprador governments. And back to your question regarding 1979 and Camp David, the Egyptian government essentially receives roughly $2 to $2.5 billion a year since 1979 for the maintenance of the Camp David agreement and essentially to help maintain Gaza as an open-air prison, as a concentration camp. So Jordan as well. The King of Jordan is just a vassal of the British and the United States and the Zionists. So what's taken so long is, I believe, the people perhaps justifiably afraid of the oppressive capabilities of their governments have been thus far reticent to put their own lives on the line, although things have gotten so desperate and terrible in Gaza that we have seen an increase in their activity. I mean, I hope others remember the lone Egyptian policeman in Alexandria who jumped up on a billboard and waved the Palestinian flag and called Sisi a traitor. He has not been seen or heard from since, but it's brave acts like this that can become contagious. And certainly in Jordan, where there is a large percentage of the Jordanian population with Palestinian heritage, I believe that the people are realizing increasingly on a day-to-day basis that they have the power and that the oppressive Jordanian government will be unwilling to face off with the Jordanian population should they ultimately make the decision to spill into the streets and to show their support for Palestine. So that's what I believe that we're seeing is just the results of months of just foot dragging and equivocating on behalf of these governments and finally the will of the people being exposed little by little, but optimally turning themselves into a flood.
What about that, Julia? Do you believe that we're at a crossroads with these Arab countries and the awakening of the people? And if you also believe that that's what's happening, I'd like to hear your perspective about how do you assess what those governments will do, because one would think that they would live in a lot of fear right now, as it appears that the people are awakening. Your take?
Yeah, so you know, it's not a stable situation for any of the puppet governments, essentially. When you have the situation in Gaza getting so bad, so brutal for so long, thirds of this population there are Palestinian refugees themselves, and Egypt people are visceral justified for Zionism in their own right. What we see right now is like the spark of at least the people saying that it's possible to stay up, it's possible to rise up. As for if there's going to be an escalation or an acceleration of these protests, of course they will be met with heavy crackdown and heavy response as they go on, and as they already have been. But it just definitely seems that that the movement at this point is stronger than the pushback against it that could be organized or enforced by these, police. So, as far as like if this will continue or if it will escalate, that's kind of yet remains to be seen. But the positive aspect of this is at least, people in these countries whose hearts are with Palestine, but who have, been limited by the conditions of their government and of their society, finally just feel like they at least can take a chance. They can at least can raise their voices for Palestine. And if it escalates, if the situation and the conditions in Gaza and occupied Palestine escalate, I do believe that both resistance as well as popular actions within Jordan and within Egypt as well will also, beat that that energy of uncontainable resistance that is bound to come even more and more to the forefront. I believe that, you know, even we see the potential of armed resistance and, you know, solidarity of with armed resistance kind of come to reinforce what's going on in occupied Palestine, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. There could be traces of that definitely in Egypt and in Jordan as popular pressure, popular mobilization comes out more and more in support of Palestine. So I don't really, you know, rule it out that these demonstrations will escalate as the genocide and as the war does. But as to the response and if these illegitimate governments in Jordan and Egypt will be able to contain it, that yet remains to be seen. But I do have faith that that it can definitely be overcome.
Okay, well, David, I mean, on the other side of things, we're looking at as far as reactions from some of the Arab countries, expanding it to even where you are and elsewhere. We have seen quite an awakening of people around the world in dealing with this situation and an awareness that we hadn't seen before. Is that it is as if the flow of information has started to, that they have been able to assess, and a lot more people are awakening to the reality. I want your take on that, and where do you see that going? For example, in the United States, we have seen protests throughout the country, and especially with the young people, an understanding of the true history of the Palestine-Israeli issue.
You know, Marzia, I believe that a large part of the dynamic since October 7th, especially regarding younger people and their awareness of Palestine, of Zionist apartheid, really does have to do with the technology of social media and specific social media platforms which prohibit American corporate mainstream media and Western corporate-controlled media from controlling the narrative. And this is absolutely critical. And I would say specifically Telegram as well as the X or Twitter platform has been absolutely instrumental. And I have firsthand knowledge of this. Right now at Cal State San Bernardino, I'm teaching a course that I teach annually on the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Certainly my students over the years have come into the class with an increasing amount of background information, and this has continued, and I've been teaching this subject matter for over 25 years, but especially this year, in the wake of October 7th, and I began teaching this course in mid-January for our spring term, and all of my students are on social media, and all of my students are following what's going on via Telegram, which is things such as the Resistance News Network, in which they can receive direct live, or not live, but almost instantaneous videos direct from the source. I have a student in my research seminar who's writing a research paper on Hamas's use of its own indigenously produced weapons. And so this student is gathering primary sources directly from social media, therefore enabling him to skip the gaslighting and the lying and the malarkey, if you will, of corporate American mainstream media, which is absolutely poison for certainly any human society, but most importantly American society, which is continually dumbed down about pressing global issues which impact Americans and which certainly impact Americans themselves and their government greatly impact. So social media is absolutely instrumental, I would say as well, the Press TV Telegram channel. So if it was only going to be relegated, that is information and stories, to the traditional standard television formats and cable news, I do not believe that youth, especially in Western countries, and by youth I mean, you know, say people under 30, would be nearly as aware of what's going on. But there is simply no way for the Zionists and their supporters here in the United States to hide what's going on when people around the world are receiving, you know, in real time, video feed from Gaza, which enables them to understand the horror of what I'm watching and your viewers are watching right now in this feed here on Press TV.
All right. Well, thank you, viewers. Stay with us as we're continuing with our sports coverage today. I'd like to thank journalist and political analyst Julia Kazem out of Beirut for being with us. We're going to be spending hours together today and looking at the demonstrations that are going to be taking place on this side of the world. And, of course, it really, the next 24 hours, protests will be taking place in different parts of the world. And Press TV, of course, will be bringing you all the latest on that. David, I'm going to stay with you right now. You just mentioned about your students and the awareness. I'm curious to understand what is happening on the various campuses in the universities in the United States. Because on the one hand, we have seen unbelievable crackdown on certain universities and as far as freedom of speech. On the other hand, we see this blowback because a lot of the students are becoming quite aware and won't step down. Your overall assessment of what is happening in the university campuses now in the States?
Well, there has been an incredible amount of resistance and, if you will, pushback from the usual suspects, from the Israel lobby, from its supporters in the American government, especially in Congress. And so we've seen some very high-profile firings and essentially harassment of faculty and administration at universities around the country. Of course, not to mention students, the doxing of students, the harassment of students who have been voicing their support for a free Palestine. However, the reality of what's been going on in Gaza, and as I mentioned related to the previous question, the fact of the awareness, which cannot be halted or turned back by the Israel lobby, by members of Congress, no matter how hard they are trying to censor these various outlets, this has further emboldened students as well as faculty who will not be silenced. And so what this has then led to, and if we take it in stages, say within a month or two, so by late December, early January, we had already reached the stage where many of the accusations and cases against professors or students had been dropped, and in which cases the pro-Palestine students or faculty themselves had prevailed. We had a very similar circumstance within the Cal State University system, and ultimately, what I'm seeing is that the reality of what's going on in Gaza, the lawlessness and illegality of what the United States and Israel are engaging in and what they're supporting is simply not enabling the usual suspects, the Israel lobby, members of Congress, wealthy Israel supporters to tamp down the genuine, real outpouring of outrage against American foreign policy and against colonialist Zionist apartheid. So what I'm saying in short is they tried. They've tried all their dirty tricks. They've tried to smear people. They've tried to dox people. They've tried to get people fired. But I really believe that we have reached a new stage whereby they are going to continue not only to be unsuccessful, but this is going to, I believe, exponentially work to their disadvantage. There is simply too much knowledge and awareness about what is going on, and I really believe that the last 6 months of genocide against the Palestinians is going to give birth, if you will, to a new generation of aware people, not just young people, but that this is truly leading to a new awareness of the reality of Zionist apartheid and what Israel and Zionism is really all about. And so, therefore, they tried. In some cases, they're still continuing to try, but they are failing. And I would just close by saying some campuses, because of their location and their demographics, are impacted less by the Israel lobby and by its supporters. And so I'm very lucky, for example, and my colleagues, Ahlam Mutaseb at Cal State San Bernardino, we have strong support from our university and from our administration, but that really does vary from campus to campus depending on the demographics. And so what we've endeavored to do is to support our colleagues at other Cal State University campuses who have one by one been successful in passing resolutions in support of Palestine, resolutions that are not watered down, that don't use weasel words, that don't do a bogus both sides thing. Mm-hmm. It's been difficult, and it's necessitated many meetings and arguments, but we have been successful within the Cal State system, which is one of the largest university systems in the world, at passing pro-Palestine resolutions. So they can continue to try, but they are going to increasingly fail, as they have been.
And on that note, appreciate you being with us, David Yacoubian, Professor of History, California State University, San Bernardino. And thank you, viewers, for staying with us on our coverage this on International Quotes Day, coming to you live from the Islamic Republic of Iran. And, of course, the demonstrations are getting started here inside of the country. We see one of the first ones right now taking place in the city or town of Yasuj. There, the first images we're getting this morning of the demonstration, of one of the demonstrations in one of the cities. This coming out of Yasuj. And, of course, throughout the country, there will be protests here in the capital. Tehran will be starting in less than a half an hour. And, of course, because it is the month of Ramadan, it is very, very significant that people go out and, of course, they're not eating, they're not drinking, and to show their commitment to the Palestinian cause. And one would think that was one of the reasons that Imam Khomeini actually chose the last Friday of the month of Ramadan. Now we're looking at images coming out of Khorramabad there, another city in Iran, as people are starting to gather to show their support for the Palestinian cause. And as I said, of course, this year we're expecting numbers unprecedented throughout the world, as the outrage of the people have reached an unbelievable level after seeing this continuous genocide, this Holocaust that has been taking place for now 6 months in Gaza. And at the same time, we don't want to forget what is happening on the West Bank, as the oppression also is at unbelievable levels, and that they are losing people every day and being arrested, being kidnapped, being tortured. The Zionist regime, not only in Gaza, but it continues its atrocities on the West Bank occupied territories. Again, live images coming out of Khorramabad, and now we're here at the capital, starting to gather there in Tehran. The official time, actually, of the demonstration was about, starting time was a little bit later, but we see already people are starting to gather there in the capital city. People are outraged. People, in many ways, feel that they just want to do something. They want to be a part of the resistance, to show their disdain for what is happening in Palestine to the Palestinians. And again, we're seeing these live images just coming in now from Tehran. Also, what you're looking there now, these are the bodies of the martyrs who were martyred in Syria at the consular section of the Iranian embassy a few days ago. This is another reason people are outraged at this unbelievable attack, actually, on Iran, on sovereign territory of the Islamic Republic by the Israeli regime. And we have seen very muted responses coming from a lot of these Western governments, not condemning this other crime by the Israeli regime. Two top generals and their companions were martyred in that attack. And you see there, people have come out and paying their respect for these are other martyrs, really, for the cause of Palestine. Again, we see the numbers of people just starting to come out and attending this rally, and also this farewell to the martyrs that were killed in the Iranian consular section in Damascus by missiles that were shot from a drone from the Israeli regime. And, of course, the Iranian nation is outraged with that attack and have been outraged in general and an outrage because of the overall existence of the Zionist entity and what it has been doing to cause, create such chaos for the Palestinians and for the region. You know, it's interesting, we go back, keep going back to 1979, and of course that was the year of the Islamic Revolution. I mean, one of the major slogans that Imam Khomeini actually coined was that it's a cancer. The Israeli regime is a cancer and cannot exist, that if it's not contained, if it's not taken apart, it will continue to try to expand, and that's what we're seeing, that's what we have seen taking place over the years. I'd like to welcome my next guest to this part of the program out of Oakland, California, Abbas Motaqim, activist, organizer, and podcaster, and out of Sydney, director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Tim Anderson. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off in Oakland. And Abbas, well, Abbas, give me your thoughts this today on the International Boats Day.
Yeah, first and foremost, today is a day where we should strengthen our courage for the liberation of humanity. And when we talk about the liberation of humanity, the liberation of Palestine from the Zionist control, if we do not liberate Palestine from the Zionism, humanity will not be free. So the 1979 revolution in Iran, it really pointed a new direction for us as Muslims across the world to center coups, to center the liberation of Palestine in terms of the Islamic struggle, in terms of an Islamic duty for us, right? So today it's very important that we center the resistance, center the Islamic resistance, center the axis of resistance that is engaging in a humanitarian struggle against the genocide that has been waged by the Zionist regime. We should also very much understand that the Zionist regime, it gets its power from the so-called United States of America. The United States of America supports the Zionist regime politically, militarily, socially, and economically. We might have seen Vice President Kamala Harris talk about a ceasefire, but in reality, the U.S. is giving direction, the U.S. is giving operation and military support to the State of Israel. So for us who are here living here on stolen land in the United States of America on this Coups Day, we must very much so look at our own backyard and understand how our own country, the so-called nation that stole enslaved African people from the continent, made all the labor off of enslaved labor, today is still, in many ways, this great Satan that is exporting its racist, imperialist, capitalist hegemony on the world. And if we believe in humanity here in the United States of America, it is our duty. It is our duty to fight. It is our duty to fight for independence, not only here in the United States of America, but understand that the United States is being fought against here in its own soil. How could it then support the so-called Zionist regime that is occupying the land of Palestine? So for us, we must support the complete freedom, the complete independence of Palestine. We're talking about every inch, every millimeter of Palestinian land must be free, and we will not stop struggling until every inch of the land is free.
Well, Tim, your thoughts on this day and why perhaps this year it's going to be different than other years because of course, what has happened in the last 6 months and the significance overall of this unity and seeing people take to the streets and raise their voices against the regime.
For inviting me along. Of course, Al-Quds Day is something that flags the important leading role of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the support for Palestine and the support of all of the resistance factions. Secondly, of course, it's a call to the Islamic world through being on the last Friday of Ramadan. But thirdly, it's also an invitation, I believe, to the rest of the world from all different cultures to support the people of Palestine and to support what is called in Quranic terms the Mustarafin, the oppressed of the world. This is something that goes beyond, as the previous guest just said, just the people of Palestine. But, of course, the issue of Palestine, as you say, is urgent now because the masks have fallen from the faces of Israeli fascism, and really that in itself has turned the world extremely pro-Palestinian. There are huge changes in virtually every country of the world, Of course, the elites of the world are still embedded with this outpost of imperialism, but nevertheless, the people of the world have woken up, and things can never go back to the way they were. And a lot of that is due to the unrelenting and constant support of the Iranian Republic to the people of Palestine. And so we get that source of inspiration here. Here in Sydney, Australia, we have rallies every week. We have actions against Israeli ships, against arms manufacturers and so on. So there's a constant flow of activities for people to participate in, and it's mobilized a new generation of people. And a lot of that is thanks to the constant, persistent support for the resistance from the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Well, Tim, staying with you, your assessment, because you talked about what is happening inside of Australia right now, your assessment overall, do you see a growing awareness of the overall situation across the board, and especially when it relates to the United States and its unbelievable support and basically in-hand partnership with the Zionist regime? I mean, your assessment of the overall understanding now of the population in Australia regarding this situation?
Well, we're one little corner of the Anglo-American world, you know, culturally speaking, and our elite is very dependent on taking orders from Washington. So in a sense, we reflect some of that there. I think that the importance of the constant mobilization of popular support for the Palestinian struggle is that it puts all of the elites on the back foot. They have to try and justify themselves. They have to come up with pretexts. They have to find some ways of mincing words to try and fool people that they're really doing something in support of Palestinian people. And that is, as I said, a reflection in some respects in our society of what you see in the US now. The Biden administration, for example, is taught, they know that they've lost the young generation in the US. That's been very clear. The Zionist lobby in the US is panicking about that something like 70-75% of the young generation is totally alienated by what the Biden administration is doing supporting this genocide. And of course, the resistance in Palestine itself has effectively destroyed the capacity, the independent capacity of the Zionist military, and it's relying almost entirely on international support. So for that reason, demoralizing, undermining, fragmenting the international support that continues to give propaganda, military, financial support to the Zionists becomes very important, because the Zionist regime is standing on that international leg at the moment. It can't do what it's doing in Gaza without the constant flow of international support in the form of weapons, propaganda, and money.
Well, Abbas, your take on the situation inside of the United States and the growing awareness. I mean, we've been talking about the awareness of the young people. Your assessment of that, and do you see it expanding? Because, of course, with the Israeli lobby and overall the strength of Zionism in the United States, there's constant misinformation that is trying to be given to the American populace about what they try to show as a reality, but which, of course, are lies. Your take, your overall assessment of what is happening there.
Yeah, Huey Newton, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party here in Oakland, California. Huey Newton, he once said, the youth inherit the revolution. And here in the so-called United States of America, inside the imperialist belly of the beast, we're seeing the youth rise up in many ways and take to the streets and make demands. But we also got to understand, as the people who see the humanity of Palestinians are rising up here inside the United States of America, there will also be counterinsurgent strategy and counterinsurgent tactics trying to and making the attempts to stop the rebellions of the street. And what I mean by that, now in America, we're seeing what we call the nonprofit industrial complex. We see these neoliberals. We even see these Democrats who try to pretend like they're some good people. What they do is essentially they fund these actors who might say, oh, we are anti-Zionist, but in the reality, they're actually liberal Zionists. They want a two-state solution. They just want a ceasefire and to go back to life as they knew it before October 7th, because in many ways, October 7th was the first time that a lot of these people have been paying attention. But in terms of struggle in the United States of America, we must in many ways graduate. And what I mean by that is we have protest after protest after protest. In the Black Lives Matter movement, we have protest after protest after protest. But what happened? No material change happened. And in reality, we saw a stronger police state being birthed. in many ways, that's what's happening right here in the United States of America, is this introduction of cop cities, these military occupations and police training centers that are now being deployed. This is a part of this counterinsurgent tactic. So for us, we must graduate our struggle from a reactionary method and move in towards a more organized, more proactive and revolutionary. Because if we're continuing to just protest and yell at our oppressors without actually building proper organization, political organizations, militant organizations that can truly struggle against the United States of America, then we are failing humanity. We have a huge obligation to people all over the world. We have a huge obligation, obligation to ourselves as African people who have been held captive in this nation, who've been exploited in this nation, who've been enslaved in this nation, who've been incarcerated in this nation. We have an obligation not only to ourselves, but to humanity to engage in revolutionary struggle to free the land from Euro-American imperialism. And if we don't do that, what we are going to see is more bloodshed, but we must align ourselves as people who believe in the humanity of all people. We must align ourselves with liberation movements all across the world, from the Palestinians in Yemen, from Lebanon. We must align ourselves with these movements that are humanitarian movements, movements that are saying that we have the right to life, the right to dignity, the right to our land. We must align ourselves and engage in this struggle.
Stay with me, Abbas. Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to explain to our viewers what they're looking at. Viewers are looking at these live images coming out of Tehran where the bodies of the martyrs who were killed in Damascus, Syria, in the consular section of the Iranian consular section of the embassy. Of course, it was a missile strike by the Israeli regime and killed two top generals of the Quds division and several other individuals. And today you can see a funeral procession of the bodies that have arrived in Iran, and of course they will be buried later on. And people have gathered here in the capital, Tehran, to say farewell, goodbye to these individuals. And you know, this is not a rare image in Iran. Throughout the 44 years since the revolution, 45 years since the Iranian revolution, there has been so much blood that has been given in order to keep this revolution alive, whether inside of the country, as we saw also terrorists attacking Iran just a day ago and killing several of the security officials, or Iranians who are outside of the country in advisory position, as these individuals were, of course, helping their Syrian brothers, of course, fight against these hegemonic acts. And we have seen throughout the time of these martyrs being sent off with unbelievable farewells by the people. And I can tell you, as someone who is not Iranian and is in Iran and sees this every time it happens, there is just a type of a stronger resistance to the hegemonic entity and stronger dedication that no matter what it takes, this revolution will continue and also will help others, other oppressed people throughout the world. Again, you're looking at these live images as the bodies of the martyrs from Syria, of course, the Iranian advisors who were in Syria, and they have returned home, their bodies there. And we see the people who are also out, of course, for International Quds Day and also saying their farewell to these individuals. Tim, let me cross back over to you. I mean, looking at these images, this is part of it. When we talk about resistance, it's not just this word of basically, okay, we have to, you know, we do whatever we can. It's a continual sacrifice that we have seen, especially from the Islamic Republic of Iran over the years, from day one. Let me, I'm going to interrupt myself right now. I believe I'm crossing over to my, I think my journalist is on the ground here, correspondent for Press TV is on the ground. Let me see if we have the images from him. Do I have you, Mehdi?
Yes, Marzia. Right now, I'm at the Ferdowsi Square in central Tehran, the beginning of the funeral procession of the seven martyred Iranians in Syria begins from here, and it will continue until, you know, the Tehran University. It's a 4-kilometer walk.